And what happens when you practice noble silence? Some people, they win the Nobel Peace Prize. That's the peace, the quiet. There's too many bells in Buddhism. Quite frankly, there are. I'm always ringing a bell for this and a bell for that. It drives you crazy sometimes. It's like living in an ice cream factory. Ding, ding, ding. Anyway, so what do you want me to talk about? Some reflections. Any suggestions? How long have we got, first of all?
About an hour, hour and a half.
Hour, hour and a half, sure. Yes, go on.
On merit, you spoke about how merit.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I always like to hear about merit.
Okay, this is something which I was mentioning to somebody earlier. I think it was some of the nuns. That some monks and nuns have the idea that you want to spend as much time as possible alone in solitude, meditating, and that will give you the best opportunity to become fully enlightened. And in my early years as a monk with Ajahn Chah, that's what I always thought. And there was, it's like, it doesn't matter. No. There's another teaching of Ajahn Chah. It's not the sound disturbs you, it's you who disturb the sound. So it's fine. There's things to do, much important. So please, I don't want to disturb you. I was always a very kind guy. So I would stay behind in the monastery helping out. I still have lots of time to meditate. And one of my jobs was to do the visas for all the other monks, so I could write Thai by that time, and I could fill out all the forms in Thai language. And when it came down to the time we'd meet again after the year was finished, now you talk to your friends, and you talk, how's your meditation going? And I was surprised that my meditation was much better than theirs, even though that I was still in the monastery doing chores for people. That they had all the best time in the caves and the jungles, not having any duties at all. But my meditation was better. And at first I thought maybe I was just a good meditator, just my innate abilities. But after a while I realized that wasn't the case. That you really do need to have some merit, some good karma, some beautiful energy in your mind to be able to even to get good meditation. Otherwise your meditation is dry. You can force it, but it doesn't really get you very far. And what really changed my attitude was when I started, I learnt Pali, I taught Pali, and started reading the sutras, and it's best. Please excuse me, because you do great translations, but the best is the original Pali. And so when you, he's the head of Wisdom Publications, a great sort of publisher. So that's my little advertisement for Wisdom Publications. And in one of the parts of the Vinaya, there's a lot of Dhamma, in the rules of discipline for monks and nuns. Sometimes people miss these little pearls. In this particular case, it was one of the Buddha's chief disciples, Visakha. The chief female disciple, she was called. And I just have the whole story. That she was inviting the Buddha and all of the monks to her house for a dana, like you've invited the monks and nuns here today. And after making sure all the food was about to be cooked, she sent one of her maids to go to the temple. This was in Sawati, so this was in the famous Jetavana monastery. Go to the monastery, tell the monks the food is ready, they can now come. But what had happened, that there was a big storm that day, or that morning, and whenever it was like a big storm, it was just before the rainy season was about to start. Because there was a big storm, it was very difficult for the monks to bathe in the rivers, because they were flowing too fast, it was dangerous. So take the opportunity in a big storm to bathe in the rain. It's like a free shower. So all the monks were bathing in the rainstorm when the maid appeared. And she, you've got it. They were looking for the monks. I said, there's no monks here, there's just these naked men. So she went back. And did you tell the monks? No, madam, there's no monks there, there's just these naked perverts. Now, with Sarka, she was really a very wise woman. And she went back to, she told the maid, oh, just go back again, check again. Because she knew what was happening, that the rain had finished and they'd be dried and dressed by now. So she went back there, and the naked guys have gone. Only the monks left now. So she invited the monks, the priests come up for the meal. And so Visakha gave the Buddha and all these monks the meal. And afterwards, she said, look, I know what had happened. My maid went to the monastery. I know you don't mind being naked, you've got no attachments and stuff, but some of us people don't like to see naked monks. So I said, can I please ask to offer these rainy season bathing cloths to the monks' community? So that when they do want to bathe in the rain, they can put a little cloth around the lower part of their body. And that's where we got the tradition, which the Thai monks know, of offering Wasikasatika in the first day of the rains retreat. They're offering rainy season bathing cloths. These little cloths for the rains. On one cow pansa. That's where it came from. The Buddha said, well, it's a very good idea, but let other people offer bathing cloths to the monks as well. And Visakha said, no, can it just be me? Can I have that one privilege? That all the monks in this monastery, I am the one who offers them these bathing cloths. And not just the monks, for the bhikkhunis as well. I want to offer it for them. And also, while I'm at it, because people come to practice with the Buddha at this time of the year for the 3-month retreat, can I be the one who gives them their first meal? Can they always come to my house when they arrive? Because the first day they may not know which way to go and where to get alms food from. So the first day they come here, may they come to my house for food. And after the retreat is finished, when the monks would actually, or the nuns would go here, go there, can I be the one who gives them their last meal before they leave? So I could also offer them, some spare robes and other things for their journeys. I want to do that as well. And while I'm at it, sometimes during the retreat, there may be some monks who get sick. Can you please know that if they need special food for sickness or medicines, can they please come to my house and I'll be more than happy to offer them the food or medicines. And also, she knew she was on a roll, so go with it. Also, there is, the monks or the nuns, if any one of us are sick, we look after each other. So there may be, say, a nun who is sick, and the person looking after her may not have enough time to go and alms food herself. So can I also send food for those looking after the sick? Can I have those permission to do that? And the Buddha said, it's a wonderful idea of yours, but why should I give it to you only and not allow it for other people? And that's when Visakha said, well, because any bhikkhus or bhikkhunis in this coming rains retreat who gets a jhana, who gets any stage of enlightenment, who progresses, I will know I've given them a cloth, a robe. I will know I would have fed them. I would have known I'd looked after them in other ways as well. And when I reflect on that, I've given food to a stream winner, to an arahat. That will give me so much happiness that then I will meditate on that happiness. My mind will come peaceful. I will get very still, get deep samadhi, and see the Dhamma myself. And so that's why I want to do it. And the Buddha was so impressed in her understanding on how this whole thing works. It's not just sitting down to meditate. You need a foundation, a force of joy and happiness based on good deeds before you can actually get your mind still. And the Buddha, sadhu, 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 you've got very good understanding. And because of that, I will give you, no one else, that permission. And this is what I got from that, and I realized why I had good meditation, and why it's good for you to make merit, good karma. Serve the bhikkhuni sangha, serve the bhikkhu sangha, serve Buddhism, the Dhamma, whatever it is. Because once you've done a dana like this, you reflect upon it afterwards, before you meditate, but what you've actually done, the service you've given. And it's no exaggeration. I'm not just saying this for marketing purposes. This is right in my heart. What you're doing now is immense. Setting up a bhikkhuni sangha in our world. And you don't, you don't realize, none of you, how powerful that is. You're opening up the doors for women actually to become full monastics. And you're making us monks feel proud again to be monks. We're not discriminating anymore. And I'm not part of a tradition which discriminates. Sometimes as a monk you feel, this is not right. But now you can meditate knowing that that mistake has been amended. You feel happy. Proud to be a Buddhist. Proud to be in a religion which actually accepts people of all genders, all sexual orientations, all races, all ages. It's this beautiful acceptance and peace. You feel this is what the Buddha would have wanted. No matter what your understanding of the Buddha, you feel that this is right. And so you're part of this. Serving, supporting. And you have. I'm not sure if it's the first in Santa Rosa. He said it was the first in Santa Rosa. I don't know. Maybe the first in California. I don't know. Forgive a dana, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the Buddha in the middle. This is like hasn't been seen for over 1,000 years at least. This hasn't happened. It's happening right now in front of your eyes, and you've been lucky enough to be born at the time you've been seeing this and part of it. And when you start thinking like that, I've seen some of you getting teary because I'm getting emotional too. This is powerful. This is big. So it's not just for the happiness of this moment. Later on this afternoon or this evening or tomorrow or next week, remember this moment. Remember this moment. And it brings you so much joy, so much happiness. Your mind is so easy to keep still. It doesn't wander around restless seeking for happiness anywhere else. It doesn't get sloth and torpor and tired. You've got energy, you've got power. And you sit there and you meditate. Wow, you get deep in meditation so quickly. So easily, based on that joy. And that's what I was doing for years as a young monk, helping others, but not just helping it and forgetting about it, helping others and reflecting about it, what I've done. It's a huge boost of energy, a huge boost of beautiful energy and power. And your meditation takes off. And these deep meditations, these jhanas and everything, wow, they're incredibly powerful. Many of you have read my books or practice with people like Pa Oxide, or I'm not sure who else you practice with. You know, there's a stage of meditation when your five senses get so weak, you get to the sixth sense of mind that appears as what we call the nimitta, this beautiful light in the night. If you get a nimitta this afternoon, your nimitta will be brilliant. It'll be just so beautiful. Why? Because of what you've just done this morning. And that's one of the things I recognized later on when you started getting into this nimitta business. That sometimes your nimitta was just so beautiful, so powerful. And other times it was a bit weak. And it wasn't so beautiful. Figure out why. And I thought about what I've been doing today. And if you've just done merit, really good karma, something beautiful, something generous, something selfless, your nimitta will be just out of this world. So incredibly powerful and beautiful. And that gives you so much happiness and energy. It's so easy to go all the way into jhanas afterwards. And these days, I don't know you because I've only come for the first time here, but some of the people I've known for years, you know who the really good ones are. The ones who make merit, they give offerings and no one ever knows who they are. I know. You see them always turning up, cleaning up afterwards, you know, doing services, and no one knows who they are. They're right in the background. They're the ones who've got this beautiful, what everyone says, got a pure mind. And when they get these nimittas coming up, ooh, that's going to blow them away. The purity of the mind, this is where you see that mind. Pure, powerful, blissful, incredible. And then, if you want to get into jhanas and other stuff, it's so easy. Your mind is empowered. That's the job of this merit. Feeding gas. Pure petroleum gas sort of into your mind, so that when you know you start getting into this realm, you're powerful, you've got energy. And it's such a beautiful thing to do. You can feel it, the happiness of this. I do work very hard, but whenever I get really tired out, I mean really exhausted, which happens quite often, the experience which you probably heard me say in YouTube, I was giving some teachings in Singapore once. And what I do is I give these teachings on a Friday night, which go on YouTube, and then as soon as they're finished, off to the airport, flying in this case to Singapore, and then as soon as you land, straight to this theatre to give these talks. And gave a talk in as soon as I landed, and finished about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, there was another talk in the evening. Everyone else went off for dinner. But monks don't have dinner. And I was totally exhausted. You know, hardly any sleep. Just talking and working. And I still think, you know, that the nuns and the monks here should join Teamsters Union or something. You know, for better work conditions. But what I did, you know, I was really out of it. You know, I didn't know how I could give another talk. So what I did, I just asked, can you please give me a place, a quiet place, where I can just be by myself for an hour. And so, if I'd have just tried to meditate, tried to watch my breath, I'd have fallen fast asleep, your head down. I know that, you know, physically I was exhausted. So instead, before I started even trying to watch my breath, I reflected on what I've done in the last 24, 48 hours. How many people I'd helped. The service which I've given. All the people you'd inspired. Turn to the Dhamma. All the people whose problems you have solved. The people who should have committed suicide, but because of something I said, decided not to. Now, husbands, you know, who reconciled with their wives. Or just like last week, this Sri Lankan man came to say thank you to me because about 3 years beforehand, I'd gone to his house in Brisbane. And I heard that he had a problem with his son. And hadn't spoken to his son for 7 years. So I got his other son, ring up that son, find out where he is, and say he's ordered by Ajahn Brahm to come to the house. So this son who'd been estranged for 7 years came to the house, and I talked to both of them, and from that moment on, they're together again, talking. The son loving his father, having forgiven him, and the father loving his son, having forgiven him. And he was visiting Perth, he had to come in and say, thank you, we're still together. You know, the argument finished on that dana 2 years ago. Now imagine how much happiness I feel when I just even tell you that story. When you reflect upon it, you've done something really powerful, really good. And you're part of that. When you feel that, you get so much energy coming up. And so I did things like that, and after about 10 or 15 minutes, there's no tiredness left at all. There's this beautiful inspirational energy. You just meditate, you've got really deep meditation. Oh, really powerful. That was the best talk after that. The evening talk, wow, that had oomph and power. Simply because you knew how to use the merit. So you make merit, punya, power, giving, sharing, doing wonderful acts. And the most important thing is you remember it. Don't just throw all the merit away in the trash can when you leave here. Don't think this is ordinary. Take the merit back with you. Remember what you've done. It's big, it's huge, it's powerful. And then, if you've got any cancers, they can't stand that stuff. Tumors, sap, gone. And I mean that, I've done that, I've seen it happen many times. Depressions, selfishness, whatever it is, sap, gone. Because that energy, that power of merit, when you know how to do it, and you know how to make use of it afterwards, that is immense. Which means afterwards, your meditation takes off. I don't know how many of you meditate here, and have trouble, oh, I can't watch my breath, I keep thinking about this, if I'm not thinking about something, I fall asleep. Can you give me some technique? And you want something like, I'll watch your breath like this, or try this little attitude. And this is another avenue. Make merit. Do something good. Do something powerfully good. And then afterwards, you'll find the problem solved. It was because your field needed to be fertilized before the flowers could grow. You'd have some superpower, fast, incredibly deep fertilizer, punya. And then you meditate, or whatever happens. Wisdom and stuff all come up. Let alone making a beautiful world. And you know, having this inspiration instead of what usually happens in places like the United States. There's not much inspiration, it's mostly desperation. You don't want to do that. Get inspired, really get into it. So that's the place of merit. And that's why I don't mind, you know, busting my ass just to teach and to help out. Sometimes people, what are you going to America for? What are you going to get out of this? I said, well, absolutely nothing except raw tiredness. But what am I doing this for? Because I know it's power. To create merit. To create strong sangha. This is just the seed. Once it's going, this will be powerful for the US. Anyway, it started in your own backyard. How fortunate you are to be part of this. Wow. Anyway, so does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I love, you know, talking about these things because it's some acts of kindness and generosity which I was fortunate enough to witness, which has stayed with me for years, over 40 years. You know, one of my first acts of kindness, before I became a bhikkhu, you know, I was an ordinary layman in London. And you may not even consider this, I had this really big long hair. You know, it was like Jimi Hendrix style, and a beard underneath. And I rode a motorbike. And sometimes people say, how can you ride a motorbike? You're actually unbrown. But, you know, I was going to become a monk. So I had to get rid of my motorbike, because I knew you can't ride a bike as a monk. So I had to get rid of it. And I realized I didn't need any money as being a bhikkhu. So I had to get rid of it. So I was asking around, anyone want a motorbike? And there was a friend of my mother's. And I remember this with great joy, taking him to see the bike and, you know, let him ride it a little bit. Do you like it? He said, yeah, it's really good condition. Yeah, I want to buy this. Because in London, driving a car is a total waste of time. Too much busy traffic. Now, getting a motorbike, if you don't want to use public transport, is far quicker and more efficient. So he liked it, and then he said, how much? You know, the usual question. So let's go up to my mum's apartment, first of all, because I knew that, you know, what would happen next. So I went up there in front of my mother. I waited till my mother was present, and then he said again, how much? And I said, once again, do you really want it? He said, yeah, I want it. How much? I said, it's yours. It's for free. And that's where my mother came in. Because he looked at my mother, you know, is this guy okay? Is he like mentally disabled? Am I exploiting someone who hasn't got all their marbles? Who's a few candlesticks short of an altar? And no, he's going to become a monk, he's okay. So I gave my expensive motorbike to this guy. And then one of the first letters my mother wrote to me in Thailand, he said, this guy's never forgotten you. It's the first time anyone has ever given him something expensive for free. And that inspired him. He's learned the power of dana, of just giving. And that made me really happy. And since that time, there's so many other beautiful acts of kindness I have seen. I love telling people how our Bhikkhuni monastery started in Perth. There was, you know, we had our monks' monastery. You know, it was not fully built, but good enough. So, let's start a Bhikkhuni monastery. Let's open it up. So this was a long time before we did an ordination. And they needed a place, first of all. So, had our committee meeting. Yeah, we're into this. Start a bank account. No land, no Bhikkhunis, nothing. Just an idea. And you know what it's like, first of all, to raise money. You know, you get $100 here, $200 here, but that doesn't buy a monastery. There has to be some event comes along, some big, unexpected stuff. We had about $20,000, $30,000 which was all we had in that account. And then this guy came up to me, and I will never forget this. He was wearing jeans and a t-shirt. He didn't really look like a wealthy person. And he said, "My wife has just given birth. It's a daughter. This is my first child. And I hear that you're collecting some money to build a Buddhist monastery for women." He said, "I'm a Buddhist, not of your tradition, but I'm a Buddhist. And I want to do something, you know, for the birth of my first child, a woman. I don't know. It's very unlikely that my daughter would ever want to become a Buddhist nun. But I want her to have that choice, to have the opportunity." And so he handed me a check. When I looked at it, it was for $250,000. And he went away and I never saw him again. Simply because he wanted his daughter and other women to have the opportunity in case they needed it. And that was where we got our nuns monastery started. Now those are inspirational things which happen, which actually uplift you and think this world is an incredibly powerful, wonderful place. You go totally on faith and hope, and your accountants will say, "You're being ridiculous, you can't afford this." Never listen to your accountant on the board. Just do it, see what happens. And it's incredible, wonderful things happen. And those great acts of generosity. People who are just kind because it needs to be done. And the result of that, you get these amazing things happening in our world. Those things happen. And it's wonderful to see that. And so, never give up that faith, that inspiration, that joy. It's already started. You can't stop it now. And those are the things which I look back on life, which you never forget. Great acts of kindness. And they don't actually have to be even monetary. Even just people who just clean up afterwards. People who are kind. Do you usually get enough people cleaning up here?
Let's see.
This, I hope David knows this story, because this is in Don't Worry, Be Grumpy book. And this is especially for your daughter. Because one day, the five fingers were having an argument on who is the most important finger. And the thumb started. "I am the most important finger. I am the strongest. I am the opposable thumb, which allows you to grab things. Whenever you say okay, which finger do you hold up? Me. I am the okay finger. I am the strongest. I am the best." And then this finger put himself up. Herself up, said, "No, I am the most important finger, because I am the finger of wisdom. I point things out to people." The index finger. And wisdom is really powerful. And just to prove it, if you say number one, which finger do you put up? Me. One. I am the number one finger. Therefore, I am the best. Now this fellow put the finger up. Said, "Look, I am the tallest. I see further. And also, I am the middle finger." And we always know, in Buddhism, middle way is the best. "And if you don't believe how powerful I am, just hold me up the other way." And you see, I'm the most powerful finger. And I thought, I am the best. And that let this little one put it, this finger up. He said, "No, I am the best. Because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, I get the engagement ring. When you get married, I get the marriage ring. I am the finger of love. Without love, kindness, compassion, where would the world be? So I am the most important finger because I am the finger of love." And that left this last little finger. And what's this finger got to show for itself? And this finger said, "Actually, guys, girls, you're all wrong. I am the most important finger, and I'll prove it to you. Even though people use me to do dirty things. Even though I do all the cleaning. Nevertheless, when you pay respects to the Buddha, I am the closest. So the person who cleans up this vihara after everyone left, the one who does the dirty work, you are closest to the Buddha. Well, that's great to get your kids to clean up their room. So nice little stories, nice little Buddhist stories for everybody. So the kids could enjoy the place as well. So that's actually how we inspire ourselves and also have fun. It's one of the nicest things about the Dharma Buddhism, that sometimes people actually criticize me, say, Ajahn Brahmi should be more restrained, you shouldn't be smiling and laughing. But then if you actually have a look, you know, in the sutras, you know, the translations published by Wisdom Publications, available at your nearest bookstore, or online, Amazon. Because it's great actually to look at those, because everything which I say, you can actually see in there, and you say, wow, this is actually true. I don't make this up. And it will say, great sutra called Dhammacetya Sutra, where one of the Buddha's other chief disciples, King Pasenadi, he went to visit the monks in the Jetavana monastery. Went to visit the Buddha, actually. And when he eventually got to see the Buddha, you know, King Pasenadi was saying just how much he loved coming to the temple, how much he enjoyed, and how fortunate he was having a vihara so close to the city where he ruled in Sarvati. And the Buddha said, well, why do you like this monastery? There's other monasteries of other religions and sects. Why do you like coming here? And then the king said, because whenever I come into this monastery, it was a monk's monastery, said the monks are always happy and smiling. And the king said, yes, that's what you can expect when they're gaining sort of progress in their meditation and when insight is arising. That's a sign that their practice is flourishing. The monks are happy and smiling. So please, never trust a miserable monk. Nor a miserable bhikkhuni. When they're happy and smiling, that means something's happening there. It's the nature of the path. And that's one of the reasons I say why I ordained in Thailand. Because the monks there were the happiest I've seen. They beat the Tibetans, in London anyway. They were smiliest. And I thought that's where I want to be. And same with you. Do you want to be in a religion which is severe, cold, not really compassionate, no smiles, no happiness? Is that where you want to be? Or would you like to be in a vihara where you feel welcome, you feel happy, you feel accepted, no matter who you are, what gender, what race, what anything? You feel happy, accepted, respected. And other people's happiness make you happy too. It's infectious. There's enough miserable people out there, you know, in the world. That's why it's good being a monk, because you can actually break all those stereotypes. Especially I like travelling in trains. I don't know if it's the same, you know, in San Francisco, but when people are in trains always reading something or listening to something, they don't get eye contact. So I love getting eye contact. Looking at people, hi, I'm from Australia, where are you from? What's he on about? And I found that the easiest way is find a woman with a baby and just say, oh, what a beautiful baby you have. It's amazing just how that is a conversation opener. If you praise a mother's baby, you know, you get respect for the mother straight away. You have great conversations. So I've got all these little tricks of just making conversations with people, you know, in the weirdest of places. And that's a beautiful thing to do. It creates happiness in this world. It just makes this Buddhist path open, engaging, and happy. So you realize you're practicing here to get happier and happier and happier. Which is what happens when you let go of suffering. So to prove that, here we go. There are two types of meditation. Who knows what the two types of meditation are? Okay. Now, there's many people here have heard me before. And my first piece of advice, when I ask a question, don't answer. You'd always get it wrong. They're always trick questions. Say, no, that's not two types of meditation. I say the two types of meditation are second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. Don't tell people what they already know. That's a waste of time giving a talk or a lecture telling you what you already know. Let's take your knowledge and understanding further. Second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. Now, what is the second noble truth? I'll have to answer it myself because I've already told you not to make any answers. The second noble truth is craving, wanting leads to suffering. It's the second noble truth. So what is second noble truth meditation? Is when you want something. What happens when you want something? You suffer. So if you're meditating and you're not blissing out, you're not getting happy, you're suffering, why? Because you wanted something, you're trying to get somewhere, you want to get rid of something, that's why it's suffering. You're doing the wrong type of meditation. Stop it. Because if you are suffering in meditation, depressed, angry, whatever it is, it's because you wanted something. That's the Buddha's second noble truth. Third noble truth meditation, letting go of all wanting leads to nibbana, the highest happiness. So that's the type of meditation which I recommend. And you're really happy and peaceful. What was the cause? Because you didn't want anything. You let things be. You didn't try and get somewhere or get rid of things. You let it be. No wanting, just happy to be here with my stupid stuff and torpor, with my restless mind. Have you ever tried to stop the restless mind and get rid of it? How many of you have loved your restless mind? Just let it be. If you want to be restless, fine. There was a young woman in Perth, Australia. She had a 5-year-old son. How old is your daughter?
Visakha's age when she became a stream enter.
Wow, amazing, 8. But this was like a 5-year-old son in Australia. And one day he got angry at his mom and said, "Mom, I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving home." A 5-year-old wanted to leave home. This mom, she was so wise. I really respect this woman. And she said, "You want to leave home?" I said, "Yes, I don't love you anymore." "Okay, darling, I'll help you pack." So they went into this 5-year-old's bedroom. They had a little suitcase they used for, you know, going on holidays, packed with all the important things in life, like the Spider-Man costume, the teddy bear, whatever else they thought was important. And the mom said, "Oh, before you go, darling, I'll get you a sandwich for your lunch. No, life is a long journey, so at least have something for lunch." So at the door of her house, she waved her son off, the son carrying a suitcase in one hand, a brown paper bag with a sandwich in the other. "Have a wonderful life, darling. Don't forget to keep in touch. Bye-bye." And this 5-year-old walked to the end of the park, you know, opened the gate and went down the street, off into his life. 5-year-old left home for the first time. He got about maybe 100 yards, maybe 200 yards down the road, and felt homesick. Turned around, walked down the street, opened the gate, walked down the path, the mother hadn't moved. "Welcome home, son." That emotional intelligence. If you try and stop your son leaving home, they'll just get angry, throw a tantrum, you have a big argument, tears, don't know what else. So what did she do? "Okay, darling, I'll help you pack. Off you go." Mom knew he wouldn't go far. He turned around and come home again. Which meant there was no tantrums, no upsets, and everything was just beautiful. That was such a wise mother. So why did I say that? When your mind wants to wander off. Pack its bags, give it a sandwich, and wave it goodbye. It'll soon come back. If it likes you. That's why I always say the reason why people's minds wander off in meditation is because it doesn't like you. You've treated it so badly all these years. You've really been cruel to your mind. So as soon as meditation starts, it's like your mind says, oh God, here she is, I'm getting out of here. It's so true, you know. So when you learn how to love your mind, be kind to it. Okay, mind, whatever you want to do, it's fine by me. If you love your mind, have this good relationship to your mind, you hang out together. You know, your best friends you love hanging out with. Why? Do they tell you what to do? Do they criticize you, your friends? You don't like hanging out with people like that. Imagine you've got a friend, you know, who'd say, you know, where do you want to go today? What do you want to do today? Friends like that are so beautiful. I love being with them for such a long time. They never criticize you, find fault with you, never tell you what to do. They respect you. And you can stay all afternoon with them, having a cup of coffee, cup of tea, talking about all sorts of stuff. Time just flies by. That's like me in my mind. We're the best of friends. We hang out together for hours sometimes. Close my eyes, just my mind and me. And we time just, I don't know where the time goes, just having a great time together. Because we're friends. We're mates. The best of friends. I never tell my mind what to do. Until my mind cooperates. That is the way to meditate. A little bit of kindness. So, these are just some tips. Don't do second noble truth meditation, wanting something, controlling your mind, treating it like a servant. You know, the United States was one of the first countries to get rid of slavery. But you still enslave the mind, treating it like some servant, telling you what to do all the time. Okay, right, now you watch the breath. You better watch the breath or else. There's no way to treat anybody. Let alone the person you've got to live with for the rest of your life, your own mind. So treat it with kindness. If once it goes on, off you go. Pack its bags, it'll come back. And then it won't want to leave anymore. Because you're kind. And you're friendly. And the mind just wants to chill out with you. That's the way to meditate. Okay. Any other comment, question? It's not really a Dhamma reflection, it's more like a chit-chat. You go on.
I have a question, Fonte, about your, what are your thoughts on, like I've heard your stories about Ajahn Chah, how he made you move the pile of things around. And,
yeah, it's good.
I know there's a lot of teachers in, not just Buddhism, but, you know, other worldly disciplines, they use these kind of challenging ways to bring out our defilements. And
yeah.
I wonder what you thought about teachers in Buddhism doing that.
Maybe that would have worked in the old days, but be careful these days. I told someone recently here that I travel around a lot, so I get lots of gossip, lots of information, what's happening with Buddhism around the world. And I was in Hong Kong doing some teachings, but staying in a monastery where many visitors would come, like a crossroads. And so at breakfast I was talking with a Zen monk from mainland China. And, you know, just gossiping stories. And he said, the latest little bit of gossip from mainland China, there was a Zen retreat. And you know the Zen retreats, because the master comes behind you with a stick. And if you nod slightly, you get whacked. And so there's this middle-aged woman. She was on the retreat, and she nodded only a little bit. And she got whacked on the back by the master with a stick. And immediately she got out her cell phone and called the cops. And the cops came, arrested that monk, and took him to jail. Because you can't do that these days. You can't. So the Zen master is now in jail in China. So be careful. I'm a teacher. If I did what Ajahn Chah did, I'd be put in jail. You know, imagine making people work for 9 days for nothing. You know, imagine just human rights in The Hague. I don't know what else you'd be up for. No, exploitation, whatever. So there's so many rules and regulations these days. You've got to be very careful as a teacher. Otherwise, you'll end up in prison. Because we're at different times, different places. And really, you don't need those methods to get defilements up. There's enough defilements as it is. So, you know, just deal with the ones which you can see, first of all. And then when you understand where they all come from, you can get everything out all in one go. Go to the roots. But yeah, it's good fun at the time. One of the nicest things was it gives you lots of stories to tell people. You know, I keep on telling stories to my monks. When I was a young monk, we didn't have it easy like this, living in a nice vihara like this. When I was a young monk, we were out in the jungle being eaten by mosquitoes. We didn't have mosquito nets. That's for namby-pamby cream puffs. We were the tough ones. We didn't have this beautiful food. We just had rice and frog. That's all I had to eat. Really good fun, having stories to tell others. Most of them are exaggerated. They're good stories.
What about the tarantula story?
Tarantulas?
Is that true?
Yeah, oh yeah, the tarantulas are fine. Because you know, it's really hot. You don't know. We don't have air conditioners like you have these days. So it's really hot in the hot season in Thailand. So, you know, usually, you know, take your robe off, take your upper robe off, just got your lower robe on. And so, you know, you take a rest in the after lunch. You know, the sticky rice always makes you a bit sleepy. Have a bit of a lay down after lunch. Really hot as well. The tarantulas would always be all over the place on the ceiling. And every now and again, they'd drop from the ceiling onto your chest. Over your chest. No, it's actually, you've got to like that because it's really like tickly. They never bit you. They were just, you know, having a bit of a walk around. Oh, what are we afraid of? They don't ever bite you, tarantulas. You've watched too many movies, you guys. The same ghosts. Because some of these monasteries were really creepy. Because these are places where people were cremated. And so there's lots of ghosts in these places. I don't know, have you heard the story of the coffin ghost? This is one of the spookiest of stories. Do you want to hear this one? Okay, here we go. The coffin ghost. If you don't like ghost stories, if you get a bit scared or you've got a heart problem, please no, leave now because we don't want to cause a heart attack. This is really cool. This was actually in London. And this guy, he was going to a vihara in the evening, listening to a talk. And after the talk was finished, 9, 10 o'clock, it was dark. And the closest way back to his house, the little house where he lived, was actually past the cemetery. He'd usually go the long way around because he was a bit scared, but you know, ghosts, it's mostly superstition. So he decided to take the shortcut past the local cemetery. And this was at night time. No one was around. And they have the street lights, you know, just like anywhere else in the world. But I don't know why it is. This is actually a fact. The street lights are always further apart next to a park or especially a cemetery. It's much darker. So, you know, he's walking home mindfully. He wasn't really scared, but, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of fear there. So when he got to the halfway mark, nothing had happened. Okay, you're almost there to his home. His home was really close by. But just after the halfway mark, he actually heard something. Like something was following him. Straight away he thought, no, this is just imagination. So he kept on walking, but he was really listening this time. And sure enough, he heard something going bump, bump, behind him. So he decided to walk a little bit faster. And as he walked faster, the thing behind him also went faster. Bump, bump, bump. So he started to run. And the thing behind him also ran. Bump, 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 bump. Coming behind him. Now, he thought he was going crazy. And he made a big mistake. And the big mistake was to look behind him to see if there was anything. And when he looked behind him, he almost froze in terror. Because right behind him, going bump up, catching up on him, there was a coffin from the cemetery, vertical coffin, with cobwebs and earth coming off it. It obviously just come out of the ground, was following him. Bump, bump, bump. So he ran like hell as fast as he could. And he ran, and he could hear behind him, bump, 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 catching up on him. He got to the garden, he didn't even open the garden gate, he jumped over it. And he got to the door of his house just as the coffin came to the gate. And the coffin couldn't jump that hard, but the coffin would go bump, bump, against the gate. And he reached for the keys of his house in his pocket. And he dropped them, bump, bump, as the coffin was busting down the grate. Only another couple of hits, bump, and the garden gate was going to fall. And he picked up the first key which he had on the ring, put it in the lock, and as he was putting it in the lock, bump, as the garden gate gave way, bump, bump, as the coffin was coming down the garden path. Fortunately, he was so lucky. The key he picked up was the house key. He turned it, opened the door, ran inside and banged the door just as the coffin came to the other side. He was safe. He was in the house. And he could see the coffin through the glass of his front door. It was on the outside, but he was safe. He was home. BAM! Against the house door. Harder. BAM! And he could see the hinges of the door starting to crack. The coffin was breaking into the house. He ran up the stairs to the only other room which had a lock, the bathroom. And as he looked down the stairs, BAM! The door gave way and went flat on the ground. And he could see the coffin. And worse, the coffin could see him. And he went into the door of the bathroom and locked the door. And from inside he could hear the coffin, bump, 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 coming up the stairs. And soon the coffin was in front of the bathroom door. Bump! Against the bathroom door. Bump! And if that coffin could break down the front door of the house, he realized there was only a few more seconds. And the door of the bathroom would also break. And there's nowhere else to run. So he leant against the back wall, waiting for the last bump to break down the door. And it soon came, bump! And the bathroom door shattered. And there's only a couple of feet between him and this coffin. And instinctively, he reached for anything on the shelf of the bathroom. And it was a bottle of medicine. And he threw it at the coffin. And the coffin stopped. It stopped bumping. It froze. And he saved his life. Because you know what he threw at the coffin? It was cough medicine. It stops the coffin. At least that's what the drugstore man said. Those of you who know me would have expected something like that. That's also in the The Wealthy Grumpy book. I really thought you'd take that one out. You really thank you for reading it. Okay. Laughter is good for your health. Much better than yoga. Okay, any other comments, questions? I don't know, what was actually the question you asked me anyway? About? You asked the question about, what was it?
About teachers using challenging methods to...
Yeah, that's pretty challenging for you. Please don't get me arrested. Yeah, usually, modern people, different techniques. And you can see this of the way I teach people. humour, encouragement, motivation. Because, again, one thing which changed the way I teach serious now was a story which even some poems, the Chinese Art of War. Some really good sort of teachings in there. And one of those teachings, there was a general in the Imperial Army many centuries ago who had the perfect discipline amongst his troops. His soldiers would never disobey orders. And so the emperor heard about this and summoned this general into the royal court and asked him, why is it that your soldiers always follow your orders? Actually, I tell this into business groups. If you, now, why is it? Now, you're ahead. Do people always do what they're told? Okay, I'll answer the question. How can you get people to do what they're told? If you're the leading monastic, the abbots, over in Australia, we never call them the abbess, because that's too close to the abyss. It's true, because we had one abbot, once, one female head of the Dharmasana monastery, and that became her nickname. She wasn't the abbess, it was the abyss. So, we didn't use that one. And even Aya is a bit dangerous, because there was one nun, I won't say who she was, she became known as the Ayatollah. People, you know, this is Westerners, we'd always make these jokes. And you know, there's a reason why she was called the Ayatollah. You know, after those Iranian Ayatollahs. Anyway, where were we? About the teaching the Sangpo. When he went to the emperor, he said, why do your soldiers always follow orders? And the general said, because I only tell my soldiers to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow orders. Because I would follow orders too if they told me what I want to do. But it made, now that wasn't just, that was a simple answer, but it was much deeper than that. Because the emperor asked, how can your soldiers want to get up in the morning? How can they want to train so hard? When you order them into battle, how come they want to go into battle and be killed? And it was motivation, simple thing. He said, I've motivated my soldiers with patriotism, like manly virtues, whatever it is. I've convinced them how wonderful it is to get up early in the morning. So when the bell goes, or the alarm goes, the reveille goes, they want to get up. So I don't tell them to get up, I just tell them what they want to do. They're just waiting, they can't wait to get up early. I've motivated them so when they want to train, so when I tell them it's time to train, yes, training, exercise, ooh, they want to do that. And I've motivated them so when I ask them to go into battle and risk their lives, they can't wait, they want to. That's why they always follow my orders. Because I only tell them to do what they want to do. Because they've been already motivated beforehand. And that's always the trick, you know, of being a teacher, of being a leader. Motivate the people you work with first of all. And then you give the order, you know, can we work a little bit overtime today? Yes! Overtime! Woohoo! And if you're a good motivator, people will go that extra mile for you. Now in sport, now this happens in all types of sport, the most important person in any sports team is not the fullback, is not the striker in the football team, is not the pitcher in the baseball team, it's the manager, the coach. They get the most money because they know how to get the best out of almost anybody, the motivators. And of course, that's in any community. That's where you get the best out of people. Good motivators. People who can inspire. So that's my job, to get your donations to inspire. And that's your job, to be able to get the best out of you, you know, yourself when you're meditating. Don't control yourself. So you tell your mind, come time to meditate. Yes! Meditation! Yes! Now watch your breath. Oh, thank you. I've been waiting to watch my breath. You don't have to force it at all. You've motivated yourself, so it's easy to do. Now, the last little story. This is the story of the suicidal spider. Because once, here in Santa Rosa, A spider was born. And as soon as she was born, she crawled to the corner of somebody's house and made this beautiful web. Now, she was a perfectionist, an artist. You know, some people are just born with these gifts. You give them something to do and they make the most beautiful web. If there was like a Home and Gardens for spiders, it would be on the front cover. You know, this incredibly beautiful house is spider web. It took so much effort and so much time to build this web. And as soon as she was finished, she was exhausted. She crawled into the center of the web. Beautiful it was. Waiting for lunch. You know, a fly or a mosquito or whatever else would come in there and that would be the lunch. But before she could take much of a rest, certainly before any lunch came, the owner of that house saw a spider web in the room, got out the broom and smashed it to bits. And that spider had to run for her life. She always got caught under the broom. She had to run out of the house into safety. And she hadn't even had lunch yet. But what can you do? She crawled into the next house, another corner, built another web, not so pretty this time, but you know, good enough. Went into the corner to have a rest and wait for lunch. And then the maid, it's a rich house, the maid saw the spider web and smashed that up too. And had to run for its life again. House number 3, house number 4, house number 5. I went to 9 houses. And after the 9th house, that was destroyed as well. And after the 9th web was destroyed, that poor spider started developing PTS. No post-traumatic stress syndrome. Even seeing a corner of the house, even thinking about a corner, made the spider shake and sweat. He had so much bad experiences with house corners. I didn't know where else it could make a web. And it not only was suffering from fear, was also really hungry, hadn't eaten at all. And was also had this feeling that no one likes her. 9 houses and people try to kill her. She lost her self-esteem. Lost her self-worth. And unfortunately, spiders don't know how to get therapy. There's no spider therapist, not even in California. So she had to deal with it herself. And just like many, started thinking, nobody likes spiders. Nobody loves me. I've got no home and no place where people look after homeless spiders. And I've had nothing to eat. And there's no hope for me. And I feel terrible. And the spider started to cry. And cried and cried. And as it cried more and more, got more and more depressed. And as it thought depressing thoughts, no one likes me, there's no hope for me, became suicidal. Why don't I end it now? And put a stop to all this pain and suffering. And it became the suicidal spider. And on the sidewalk, it deliberately looked for a person walking. Especially a poor person with big shoes. And tried to crawl under the shoe to get squashed. But every time it went under a shoe, it went always between the heels and the sole. You know, the bit that was straight. Because you may notice this, whenever you're suicidal, you can't do anything right, not even kill yourself. Nothing goes right. It tries to crawl across the road and get squashed under a truck. But again, in between the wheels, never underneath the wheels. So soon, the spider got so depressed, you know, really super depressed, even gave up trying to commit suicide. What's the point? Nothing ever goes well for people like me. So suicidal spider was staggering down the sidewalk like some drunken person, not knowing where she was, what she was doing, crying and sniffling. You know the feeling sometimes that you feel that somebody's looking at you? That's what suicidal spider had. Felt someone's looking at me and turned around and saw the fattest spider that's ever existed in California. Huge spider. And this fat spider had a big smile on her face. I was looking at the suicidal spider and said to suicide, "What's wrong with you?" And suicidal spider started to cry again. So the fat spider gave it a tissue to wipe its eyes. And then suicidal spider told the story of her short, unhappy life. How 9 times she was so close to being killed. How she never had a home and was always destroyed. How she hadn't eaten since she was born. What a terrible life she had. And then suicidal spider, she had a thought. Hang on. Look at you, fat jolly spider. How come this didn't happen to you? Didn't you build a web and get it destroyed? And that fat happy spider said, "No. I've only ever built one web in my whole life and it's still there." And the fat happy spider, because fat people are always very compassionate and happy. Like Santa Claus. Look at Santa Claus. You know, fattest person in the world, always happy and laughing. Has he ever died? He was old when I was a kid. So all you people who say being fat is bad for your health, look at Santa Claus. That proves. You can be overweight, happy, and live a long life. Proofs. Anyway. It was Fat Johnny Spider saying, "I only built one web in my whole life, and it's still there." And out of compassion, he said, "Look, there's enough food I catch for more than myself. Why don't you come and live with me? We can share the web and share the food as well. We can be friends. We can be sisters. Come and live with me." And of course, the suicidal spider was very attracted. But then said, "Hold on a minute, hang on. There's a problem here. You say you've only built one web, and it's still there after such a long time, and you catch lots of food. Where on earth can you build a spider web in here in Santa Rosa? Where can you build a web in Santa Rosa where no one ever disturbs you?" And the fat jolly spider, "Oh, I built my web in the donation box of the Wihara. No one ever disturbs you there." So now you know why you should give a donation. Don't worry, there's plenty of room for your donations as well as the spiders in the donation box of this Wihara. So thank you for listening. Okay.
We had mice moving into ours at the Hermitage.
Yeah, they made a nest.
In the donation box? There we go, you're not the spider. You mean stingy people.
Next chapter.
Okay. Okay, I think it's enough fun and games. So I hope you enjoyed the Dharma talk. Now you may have noticed some of it was deep. Some of it was, some of you laugh at it, but it's actually quite important stuff. Some for the kids, because I always want to make sure that kids feel happy coming to the Wihara. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they get bored stiff. It means when they get old, they never want to come back again. But now they feel Wihara is a fun place for everybody. Very good. Okay, so now we're going to do the offering. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the donation box takes cash, checks, and IOUs. You know what IOU?
Online
donations, offline donations, yeah. Any online donations.
And then they made a money tree.
A money tree as well. Yeah, you can always clip it onto the money tree. That's always a way of doing things.
I can pass an envelope.
Yes, an envelope. So you can put like on that IOU, so pledges. Pledges. So you catch people when they're inspired. Very good.
Okay, now everyone is ready.